Hi, everyone. Thanks for coming back. Welcome back. For this first post-lunch session, I'm going to do my best to get a conversation going between you and the panel, and between all of us as soon as possible, so we can kind of fight off that carbohydrate lull a little bit. And also, partly because this session, the reporter's toolkit, it strikes me as one where probably all of us have some experience or bit of advice that we can share that would be of value to fellow participants. So my name's Emily Gertz. Welcome. I'm a member of the SEJ board. I'm also a freelance journalist. I'm based in New York City. And when Nancy first called me up about moderating this session for this workshop, she said, or we discussed, so have you covered any disasters before? And my initial answer was, hell no. My whole journalism career has pretty much been as a freelancer, albeit sometimes on long-term contracts. And at least until recently, you know, it wasn't the freelancers who were getting dispatched off to cover stuff. And if it was a local thing, then maybe I got some action. But as we talked more, I began to realize that, in fact, I even without realizing it, I have, in fact, done some disaster coverage. Scott and I were just discussing that when I was on his web team at onearth.org, the website of On Earth magazine, we essentially curated coverage of the BP oil spill, which involved us going out and synthesizing what we saw was happening, and then also looking for the right kinds of experts or other types of professionals to help us interpret it for the readers. And sometimes that was a question of finding photographs. In one case, though, I think I was among the early reporters to cover the possibility of the oil getting caught up in the Gulf Stream and coming around the tip of Florida and up the East Coast. It was a small but real possibility, and the government and BP were not too interested in talking about it, but through satellite imagery, it became clear how that scenario could potentially play out, which brings me to say that these days, there is a lot you can do sitting in your apartment in Brooklyn in terms of covering a disaster, thanks to the internet. And I'm not saying it can replace people on the ground, but with a little bit of your reporter's sense and a good list of contacts, you can do a service, I think. I think we did a service in helping guide readers through a disaster, particularly if they're far away and it's hard to figure out, you know, what's going on and which news sources are credible. By the same token, you know, as we talked, I also began to realize that although I was not a journalist in 2001, I was living in New York, and shortly after the 9/11 attacks, I assembled a little kit which I carried with me for roughly the next year or two. And the kit consisted of a real live transistor radio with a AA battery, headphones, a water bottle, spare socks, an energy bar, and an extra battery for my cell phone, which at that time was about as big as this mic. A few other dibs and dabs like that. And right around the time I retired that kit, we then had the blackout of 2003. And I packed the kit up again, and I carried it around with me for a while, because in both of those cases, I was in Manhattan. I was miles from home, and the subways were not running. And so at that point, I think I added a toothbrush and toothpaste to the kit as well, although it must be said that even in the worst case scenario, you can always find a drugstore that will sell you a toothbrush in New York City. So, and that struck me as the bare bones basics of a reporter's toolkit. Like, what do you want to have in your backpack in a disaster? If anything, that's gotten easier now, thanks to the incredible lightweight and capabilities of smart devices. I mean, at that time, I couldn't have done much more with that cell phone other than try to call people. But now, I could be reporting a story with my iPhone if I had to, and some people do that for a living. So, in a way, I think that opens up the beat to a lot of us who, for whatever reason, may not be traveling to disasters. And hopefully that's a trend that's going to continue because we can use more perspectives. With that, I would like to hand this over to our speakers, James Schwab and Scott Dodd. James is with the American Planning Association and also has training as a journalist. And Scott is the executive editor of onearth.org and the editorial director of NRDC. So take it away, Jim.
This is working. Sounds like it. Before I get into any of these slides, I want to give you a little background on me for about 30 seconds, just so that you have some idea where I'm coming from and what it is I'm going to introduce you to. Because I'm not the guy who is going to spend a lot of time on first response issues. That is not really my specialty. Scott's going to talk more about that. He said so. But I am going to introduce you to another way of looking at the whole realm of hazards and disasters that may open up some other ideas about stories that can go well beyond the narrow time frame of the event itself. So, as mentioned, I kind of have this dual existence. Long ago, I got trained as both a journalist and an urban planner. And so I've been moving back and forth between those two things for my entire professional career, going back some 30 years now. And I'm going to work from that perspective. And I think that there's a lot on the whole planning and land use front that can introduce you to some interesting questions as journalists. What I do these days is manage something called the Hazards Planning Research Center. I'm going to walk you through some resources that we are either have made available or are making available very shortly that I hope are actually useful to you in the near future. I also happen to co-edit a publication called Zoning Practice, which deals with exactly what it sounds like. It's a monthly publication for practicing planners and zoning professionals and the like, dealing with land use planning. Most of that doesn't deal with disasters, but in this other life here, I spent all my time on that. So, let's see, how does this... There. I had to figure out how that works differently from my own computer. So one of the things we're... In that research center, we produce a lot of publications of fairly substantial nature, a series of research reports, do a lot of training, et cetera, for people, largely targeting the planning profession. One thing we have coming out, and I want to talk to you about this for a minute because it really sets up a series of questions, and I hope some questions from you later, is that back in 1998, we did an earlier version of this topic called Planning for Post-Disaster Recovery and Reconstruction, which was actually underwritten by FEMA, as this was, a contract arrangement for them to underwrite the study, but totally produced by us. Basically, the thesis here is that there are things that communities can do before disasters ever happen to set them up to be more resilient in the face of disasters, to set them up to be more successful in recovering from disasters. And so the cover here is actually an example of green infrastructure. How many of you are familiar with the term green infrastructure? Okay. Good term to get in touch with in covering disasters, because the idea here is that actually we can use Mother Nature to kind of ameliorate some of the impacts of disasters instead of always taking the hard structural approach to trying to protect our communities. We spend a lot of time in here talking about both the limits and the opportunities involved in what communities can do in pre-disaster planning with examples. In case you didn't know it, there are actually communities doing this kind of thing. Florida has something called post-disaster redevelopment plans that are basically pre-disaster plans, talking about some of both how they're going to manage the disaster as well as some of the policy questions that they want to address that are generic enough to be able to set up the stage before the disaster ever occurs. But at the same time, there are limitations because at some point you have to know exactly what the pattern of damages was from a disaster to know how you're going to rebuild specific parts of the community. Here's my suggestion from a reporting standpoint is it's important to know the first responders in the community and the emergency manager and those folks who handle the immediate cleanup and response and search and rescue and all that. But for the longer term stories, it's also important to know the folks in that planning or community development department. They're doing some very important things, for example, in New York City, and that is actually a picture from Brooklyn, in response to the need to rebuild parts of the community. It's also a huge issue in places in New Jersey. There are some huge governance issues related to New Jersey that are very different from New York. Understanding, why this all makes a difference is very important. I don't have time to go into all of that in detail, but I just want to introduce the topic. So what are we trying to, this is basically, we have a website where you can actually access a lot of information about this project already, because while the report is due out in early December, figure around December 10th or 12th, any of you want to get an electronic copy the minute it comes out, give me your business cards afterwards. I'll have our public information person shoot you that link as fast as it's ready. But basically, there's also on our website at planning.org, you can go in there, and there's a lot of background on the project in progress, including a blog that is about 3.5 years old called Recovery News. I encourage you to rummage through there because we put stuff out regularly that kind of enhances some of the background stories about specific places and events and resources that you may find useful. In addition, speaking of what you can do before a disaster, here's an interesting question for the communities that you're covering. Have they even thought about the possibility? And I'm telling you that we are pushing the envelope with communities, and I deliberately push the envelope in a lot of the research we do to get them further out on the cutting edge of what they could be thinking about, what they could be doing. But one of the things we include in there is a model pre-event recovery ordinance that we have drafted that covers a lot of the things that communities can do in advance, including setting up a recovery management structure, some of the issues related to do you want to set up a moratorium on development for a certain period of time in order to have, buy time to think about where you want to rebuild and how you want to rebuild before you let people just start rebuilding willy-nilly. So very important, take a look at that. That's already up there. There's a draft version, but it will be replaced within a matter of days by the final version. And here's just sort of an example of some of this material from that Recovery News blog. Now, this you can get already, and I'm going to have some of the links up here. And are these slides made available to people? They will be. Okay, so you will be able to access those links in case you don't write them down quickly enough. 4 years ago, we did something else that I consider extremely important, and this has been pushing the envelope even with FEMA. You can see the FEMA policy changes if you track this stuff closely enough. I had approached FEMA after Hurricane Katrina about the fact that a lot of local hazard mitigation plans. Anybody familiar with those? You know what those are? A few people. Okay, the rest of you are going to need to find this out. But you can download this report. They are plans that communities are expected to do to outline how they plan to mitigate the hazards that exist in their communities and get approved by FEMA as complying with the Disaster Mitigation Act and the accompanying regulations in order to be eligible for any federal mitigation grants as a result of a disaster. This is critical. I can tell you firsthand, November 2005, I was down here in New Orleans meeting with the planning director. New Orleans did not have an approved hazard mitigation plan in place before Hurricane Katrina. They had a rejected, twice rejected draft plan that was not adequate. I looked at it. I can discuss what some of the problems were, but it was clearly not up to snuff. And as a result, they weren't eligible for any mitigation grants until they got that problem fixed a few months later. So a very important report. Basically, what this was about was how can communities take that plan, take hazard mitigation priorities, and integrate them throughout the rest of the planning process in the local community, the comprehensive plan, the zoning ordinance, all its implementation tools, in order to make sure that those ideas actually went into practice. Critical concept that FEMA has been advancing ever since, because it really speaks to what the level of commitment within the community to solving these problems. So here's the set of links for both the project site for the forthcoming report, which is not out yet. The one that I just showed you, our hazard center, and my contact information, and I believe that's the end of the show.
Perfect.
How's that for timing?
Perfect.
9:08. Okay, thanks, James. I'm just going to go straight to Scott, and after he's done, we'll start to discussion and taking questions.
Great. As Jim said, he was sort of here to provide the overview. And Emily asked me to sort of provide the boots on the ground view. I was a reporter for 8 years at the Charlotte Observer, and I think I covered about 8 hurricanes in that time. The biggest were Floyd, Isabel, and Katrina. During Floyd, my car nearly got flooded, and one of my fellow reporters did lose his car in that storm. During Isabel, I got arrested at gunpoint by the National Guard. During Katrina, I slept on the floor of the Biloxi Sun Herald for a week, where they had no air conditioning and no working plumbing, anything like that. So when you talk about toolkit, I take toolkit very literally. I learned over the years that you're going into these situations, you need to bring everything that you could possibly imagine that you're going to need with you, and sometimes things that you couldn't possibly imagine. When I was leaving to go down and cover Katrina, it was the first like big storm or disaster that I had covered after I had gotten married, and my wife packed up this she tells this story on herself, where she packed up this little cooler for me with a couple treats and snacks and stuff like that, in case I, might need it. And I said, oh, great, honey, that's great, thanks. Put it in the giant SUV that we rented that we then drove over to the Walmart parking lot and filled with about $5,000 worth of supplies, because we knew we were going into a situation where, we wouldn't see water or gas or electricity or anything like that, possibly for weeks, which is indeed what ended up happening. One of the nice things about hurricanes is it's, one of the few natural disasters that you can really see coming, that you actually have time to prepare for some of this, to make sure that you've got what you need, that you're situated well for it, and things like that. So it's really important to take that time to try to think through, okay, what are all the situations that I might encounter, and what do I need to be aware of as part of that? And so what do I need to bring with me? Now, obviously, there are going to be plenty of things that you're never going to expect. But if you at least spend the time to think some of those things through, as opposed to just jumping in your car or jumping on a plane and heading down there without any idea what to expect, you're going to be in a much better situation when you get there. Katrina, the photographer that I traveled with, and I, the most important thing that we brought with us, well, t- two important things. Satellite phones, because the entire cellular network was out along the Gulf Coast. We filled six big cans with gas and strapped them to the roof of our SUV. We protected that gas, you know, night and day. Like, I slept on the conference room floor. He slept in the SUV to make sure that nobody took our gas. And everywhere that we drove, people would offer us, like, you know, $100, $200 for one of those gas cans. They were desperate for it. But we knew that there were no gas stations working for, you know, at least 100 miles around. And that was going to be our only way home. When we decided that, okay, it's our time to go, to pack it up and leave, that's what we're going to do. We were lucky that we had a lot of support, too, from Knight Ridder newspapers. This was when the Charlotte Observer and the Sun Herald were both still owned by Knight Ridder. So that's why we had gone down there. We'd gone down there to assist the staff of the Sun Herald, which, you know, many of them lost their homes, they lost family members, they lost their building. You know, they could still stay in it, but it didn't have electricity or working presses or running water or anything like that. So, and the satellite phones that we brought down were the way that they transmitted the paper every day. Transmitted the entire paper from a little portable satellite dish that we set up on the roof of the SUV, and transmitted everything back. So, you know, so that was a situation where if we had not made it down there with our satellite phones and the equipment that we brought, they would have missed publication for a couple of days. And they managed to not miss publication. So they were, I think, the only publication on the Gulf Coast that didn't miss at least a day of print publication. You never know exactly what you're going to need with you, but if you've spent a little time sort of studying what's happened before, hurricanes on the Outer Banks, for instance, which I covered a couple of, tend to be pretty predictable. I mean, you sort of have a sense of where the storm is probably going to come in, what the impacts are going to be on things like the Sound and the Barrier Islands and things like that. You know, the safest town to be in is probably Nag's Head because of where it's situated. So there are a few things that you can do and that you can be prepared for. One thing that I always had in my toolkit was a big coffee table book called North Carolina Hurricane History. And it was filled with pictures and facts about every hurricane that had ever hit North Carolina. So whenever I went out to cover a storm, I would look up, okay, when was the last storm to hit this place? What did it do? I'd have like a bit of a sense of that. You know, every storm can be different, but it gave you some clues. And it was also kind of cool because you could see, oh, well, the lighthouse was wiped out like 30 years ago. Let me go check out the lighthouse and see what happened there. And you've got a nice reference back to the last time. Or, you know, the last time that a storm came through, the courthouse was underwater. Well, this time it wasn't. The storm wasn't as bad this time. And those types of things can really be helpful to have that kind of information. So I mentioned to Emily earlier that one of the funny things is that even though I had covered all of these storms when I worked at the Observer, Charlotte never actually got hit by one or by anything more than, like, you know, some tropical storm force winds or things like that. Then I move up to the New York area, and we get hit by Sandy. And, you know, and my home is actually, like, underneath the hurricane, and we lost power for 8 days. So even though I had spent all this time, like, covering these storms and knew what to do when I was going out to one, actually living through and experiencing one with, like, you know, with my family, with my home, with, you know, our entire town, every power line in it down and things like that, it just gives you a much different perspective. And my go bag wasn't all that helpful because I wasn't going anywhere. I was stuck there and I had to deal with it. So there's, it can vary a lot depending on where you're going, on the situation that you're going to be in, what you need. But I always think that thinking about it in advance, putting some planning into it, and learning very much from the people who have gone before is really important. Handout that I brought, which I don't know if it's been distributed yet, but it's up front. Bill made copies for us. Thanks. This is a handout that I put together right before I left the Charlotte Observer with the editor who I'd worked with for many years. And on the front is sort of a survival guide talking about a lot of the stuff that I just said, you know, what to do before you leave, how to be safe, plan for food, energy, gas, hotels, things like that. And it's got a packing checklist on it. Then on the back is just some advice for getting the stories, where to go, who to talk to, what to expect. This was in the days where we still had rewrite men back in the newsroom. And so if you were on the front lines, it was your job just to gather information. You didn't worry about how you were going to put the story together or anything like that. You just got the information, you got the quotes, you got the details, and you found a way to get them back to the desk. And then you just let somebody else worry about writing it. I wasn't particularly good at that because I was a control freak, and so I wanted to like both do the reporting and the writing. Once I learned to let go of that and let somebody else, like, you know, I worried about finding out what was going on and somebody else worried about like the bigger picture and putting it all together, it made it much easier to sort of know and understand how to cover these kind of storms. So that's my that's what I bring to the table. And then, as Emily said, now I'm in the position of assigning a lot of these stories, and figuring out how to do it with a much smaller, more limited staff, which is something that we're all doing nowadays. So and often finding a way to do it from a distance. So I've got some experience in that too that we can talk about.
Great, thank you. I'll start us off with a question for Jim. Jim, you mentioned a sort of a rather serious and significant mistake that New Orleans, or let's say a mistake of omission that New Orleans made prior to Katrina. Taking it around to journalism, I wondered if there's anything you have observed as sort of best in show as well as worst in show among reporters you've dealt with in the context of disaster reporting, especially because you have some appreciation of journalism from your own experience.
Boy, it's a lot easier to answer the best in show than to start picking on the worst in show. I actually think that, I don't know, maybe sometimes the worst circumstances produce some of the best journalism. Because the work that Mark Schlefstein and some others at the Times-Picayune, I think, was remarkable with the way that it handled that. It, not only the coverage of the disaster itself, but before that ever happened, they had a series in the Times-Picayune talking about what would happen when the big one hit New Orleans. A lot of it pegged the issue very precisely, and of course got very little official response. But that's not their fault. That's the fault of the officialdom that didn't take it seriously enough. But they, for getting on the issue ahead of the bulk, ahead of the curve, I think that certainly takes best in show, and I give them a lot of credit for what they did. Because that series was out in, I think it was 2003. 2002. I couldn't remember exactly which year, but so 3 years ahead of that event itself. Of course, you never have any idea, you know, when this is actually going to happen, but at least putting out in front of the community, these are the stakes, these are the consequences if we don't get our act together, is, as I think, really a critical piece of foresight journalism. Worst in show,
there's one thing we were discussing last night, as you might recall, how we were discussing that so often officials later get away with saying there was no way we could have seen this coming.
Yeah, there's that. I was actually going to answer your worst in show with something else, which is, but I'll get to that. Because it just occurred to me, one of the things that I found as, in my position, I'm playing both sides of the fence here, because sometimes I'm actually writing about this stuff. I've written about Sandy. But sometimes I'm also, through APA, the person you guys are calling for some perspective on some of this. And I remember after Hurricane Katrina, oh my God, the phone never stopped ringing. I was keeping a log of the interviews I had done because I was afraid I couldn't remember them all. One of them was somebody from CNN, sadly enough, who wanted to know the simple. She wanted a yes/no answer to the simple question of rebuild New Orleans, yes or no. And I said, well, that's not a yes or no question. And I would start to elaborate on some of the issues. You know, there's a lot of social issues. There's a lot of context issues. There's a lot of everything that makes that a very complex question. Well, damned if you wouldn't follow that up with, so, Mr. Schwab, rebuild New Orleans, yes or no? And I said, I'm not going to answer that question that posed in that fashion. It, you know, I just refused. To me, that's kind of simple-minded nonsense. It's just, you know, that's worse than show, that kind of stuff. Because most of these questions are a lot more complex than that kind of thing. I don't know where they dug that person up or why CNN would ever have hired somebody like that. But the other question about, remind me what you...
The notion that we could never have seen this coming.
We
were talking specifically about the series
that
the Times-Picayune did, and only to have the president say there was no way we could have seen this coming.
This is a thing, you know, this is not a question of bad journalism. This is just a question of the official line, but it happens over and over, and I think journalists need to be relentless in pointing out why that answer, more often than not, turns out to be pure bullshit. I'm just going to be very blunt about it. You know, President Bush standing up there after Hurricane Katrina and saying we had no way of knowing that the levees would fail was one of the most... I was livid when I watched that press conference on TV. I mean, I was watching them live, and I was like, God damn it, you know. Because I was well aware of how many reports there were out there talking about the state of disrepair with the levee system, why they might fail. You know, you can just, if you go through the literature, you can find example after example of forewarnings on this problem, and not just in New Orleans, by the way. I want to make clear, we should not just pick on, you know, this is not a problem isolated in New Orleans. One of the reasons within a couple of years after Katrina that there was a $5 billion ballot issue, bond issue on the ballot in California was that Governor Schwarzenegger, looking at what happened down here and thinking about the mess that is a levee system in the Sacramento San Joaquin Valley in California, and if you've ever had the chance to get out there, or if you ever get the chance, I took a tour with a person from the California Department of Water Resources. I mean, they've got at least as big a mess as New Orleans had, and it's just a question of when the system collapses somewhere in the future. And that's why he got spooked and put that on the ballot to raise money to invest in trying to fix that system, because you've got this big delta. And
okay, so simple yes or no questions are probably signs of lazy reporting.
Exactly. So those kinds of answers, chase them down every time.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's
okay.
My answer.
And Scott, I wanted to ask you, so it interests me that, you know, what you said about the satellite phone, because of course, you know, it makes perfect sense as soon as you think about it. Like, do you feel that there's a way... With so many of us freelancing now, is there a way that freelancers can get access to some of this equipment so that they can, if they can get an assignment and get into the field?
I think it becomes a lot harder. I mean, it was, you know, I had never felt better about working for Knight Ridder than I did while covering Katrina, because of the support that they poured into the Sun-Herald. And this is at a time where Knight Ridder was basically fighting for its life, and within a year it no longer existed. It had sort of, you know, it had sold itself off. But the photographer that I traveled down there with and I were just like part of the first wave of people that they sent in there. I mean, I think eventually more than 100 Knight Ridder, reporters and editors and photographers went down to help out with the Sun-Herald. There were plans in place for this sort of thing. I mean, this was expected. Like, you know, it was sort of you know, yeah, you sort of had to improvise a little bit, but like everyone knew that eventually we were going to have to do this, you know, and if it wasn't here, it was going to be in Miami, or if it wasn't there, it was going to be in Mobile, Alabama. I mean, so there was no, you know, so there was some sort of preparation and forethought, and there was an organization behind you that you felt supported by. You know, there was supply lines, there were efforts. I think it becomes really hard in a day when, you know, most reporters, well, not most, but where an awful lot of reporters now are freelance, where there are not the sort of staff organizations to do this. I'm very careful as, you know, as an assignment editor for a small magazine, that I don't want to send people into places where I can't support them. When we sent, when we did send some people down after the Gulf spill, you know, it was a couple weeks later. It was to do more sort of perspective pieces and things like that. And the Gulf spill was not something where the people, you know, on shore were immediately impacted. They were immediately at you know, risk of you know, of life and limb. But it was still something where I didn't want to put somebody there who couldn't be prepared. You know, Sandy was a little bit different because we had so many people right there in the area. Or last year after the Boulder floods, again, you know, we had contributors right there in the area. But I think about that a lot as an editor. If I can't, if I don't feel like I could support someone in terms of the logistics and the kind of support that I knew that I had as a reporter, I don't want to send them into that situation. And, you know, I don't know what the answer or the solution to that is, because I do think there needs to be an infrastructure to support the kind of crucial on-the-ground reporting that needs to happen in the days and weeks after something like this. I mean, yeah, you can do more of that from a distance than you ever could before, but you do still need people on the ground, and you need eyes, and you need people talking to the people who are actually affected by it. And and newspapers traditionally were the people who did that. That was the front lines. Those were the people who were able to put those kind of resources into doing that. And as fewer newspapers are around to do that, I don't know what the answer is or what the solution to plugging that hole is. If anybody else does, that'd be great.
All right. Yeah, let's start talking.
Yeah.
Please say your name before you ask your question.
I just wanted to respond to that. This is Jonathan with the Jonathan Henderson with the Gulf Restoration Network. Shortly after the Deepwater Horizon exploded and sank, I was on a plane flying over it, flying over the source, and I'd continued to do that all summer, taking aerial flyovers and taking boat trips, taking trips by car and foot. Fast forward to today, I've taken over 200 trips by air and boat and foot, monitoring the ongoing BP impacts, but also the impacts, other leaks and spills. But very quickly, because of that early work that I did getting out into the field, I was able to provide information to journalists from all over the world, and I became a go-to source for journalists from all over the country and all over the world. And so they would come to our organization because we had connections and boat captains that weren't commandeered by the Vessels of Opportunity program, or pilots that were willing to take us out on flyovers. And then also a knowledge of the terrain. And so it's still today. We get asked to take the media out on trips. Just on Monday, I took out somebody from the New York Times to doing some aerial photography. And so that's what I would recommend, folks, is to find out who are the people that are on the ground there that can provide you that access. Now, I always say, you know, if you're buying, I'm flying, because I work for a small environmental nonprofit, and we don't have the budget to do it. And seriously, out of the 200 trips that I've taken, I can count on one hand the number of times we actually paid for the boat or the plane, because we simply don't have the resources to do it. That you guys coming to us helps us to get out into the field. So it's a good relationship, but that's one way to do it.
Hi, Hi, Sharon Friedman from Lehigh University. Jim, I have a question for you in relation to the hazard mitigation plans.
Sure.
I've looked at a few of them, and I don't see, at least around the Philadelphia region, and I don't see very many, but very much information about communication and working with journalists and others in these plans. Is there a requirement for that?
I don't know of a requirement for working with journalists. I do know that, and this certainly should create an opportunity in that direction, if for reporters who alertly follow what's going on with the process of doing those plans, that there are definite requirements for public participation and engagement in the development of the plan, so that, you know, holding public meetings, you know, airing various iterations of the plan as it's in development, which should allow the opportunity to get into the process and ask questions as that plan is being created. But in terms of direct communications with journalists, I don't know of anything that's been required.
Mostly just one meeting, open meeting per year in most of the surrounding counties, with the exception of Philadelphia, which had about four. So very little interaction.
Yeah, that's a problem. And, you know, this gets back to why we chose to do that work in the first place. I didn't go into quite as much background as I will in answering your question, which is that, you know, the Disaster Mitigation Act, which put those plans, started the process of requiring those plans as a basically the requirement for getting the federal mitigation grants in the communities and at state level as well. You know, that was back in 2000. By 2005, when we had Katrina, the biggest problem was whether the communities were even doing the plans in the first place. Although a number of them were, and the number has grown quite rapidly, up to now it's over 20,000 communities that have plans in place. So the quality of the plans is a second factor, though, and what we found was a lot of those plans, even when they were done, were typically done, they were assigned to the local emergency management office. Well, FEMA's middle initials are emergency management, right? So the structure of the system is such that the stovepipe goes down from FEMA at the national level through state emergency management offices down to local emergency management offices. That vision of who should be involved in this has been broadening, but it's taken a lot of work. And at the point when, you know, post-Katrina, when I brought this idea to FEMA to do that work, the question was, how are you going to move this beyond that stage? Because those folks have very little training outside of first response. And the rubber hits the road with most of these questions over on the planning and land use side. I mean, when you look at, this is one of the issues with the New Orleans plan in the first place, was that that plan was developed strictly by the New Orleans Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Response, whatever it was, and no involvement whatsoever from the planning department, and yet you look at where the problems were in terms of mitigating the hazards from things like levee failures, floods, hurricanes, the whole, you know, suite of hazards facing New Orleans, and a lot of them were land use issues, building too close behind the levees. Well, who's responsible for that? That's a planning question. It's not an emergency response question. And so the question was, who's involved in actually developing the plan, and how can we broaden the involvement to include the people who really need to be at the table discussing this stuff in the first place? And so that was the big push there. But in the process, the other thing that goes on is that, you know, I may be biased in saying this, but I think it's actually true, the planners actually have training in managing public participation in the planning process. Emergency managers often don't. Now, I'm not trying to cut down emergency managers. It's just that more players need to be at the table here in the first place in order to open up that process. And then we need to make sure as well that the journalistic community and the public have access, and that this stuff is more transparent, and that you have more than one public meeting before you approve that plan, that people have adequate access to actually comment on the thing and to report on it, and hopefully they're local reporters are following it and raising questions, you know, as well. So, yeah, I mean, I agree. There's got to be a lot more openness in a lot of those plans and a much broader suite of players involved in developing them.
It just occurred to me to mention, stepping back to the question of freelancers and disaster coverage, that essentially, I guess, my approach, as I've been freelance my whole journalism career, and I don't, you know, even if I was more constitutionally inclined to go rushing into a disaster zone, which I can't honestly say I am, there's also the fact of the infrastructure and the knowledge that I don't have a lot of support if something happens to me that has also held me back. But there are lots of stories to be found in a couple weeks and a couple months, you know, or years after a disaster. And I think that that's an arena where we as journalists get a lot of grief from the public because we rush to the scene of the crisis and take the photogenic photos and then rush away, leaving it to the local press, which is in various states of decline in some parts of the country now, to pick up the pieces. And so, for instance, Grist, in one of my rare paid for junkets, I went from Brooklyn to St. Louis to cover the Mississippi River, and our hook was, it was 10 years after the Great Flood of 93, which was an utter disaster that no one talks about anymore, and what was happening in the St. Louis area in terms of development. For that same series, I didn't get to go to Biloxi, but I talked to people in Biloxi about a plan that was underway to rebuild homes in a low-income neighborhood. In terms of my own backyard, last year I reported on a neighborhood in Staten Island that it, basically the entire neighborhood is selling out to the state, and most of them very with some relief because they were destroyed in Sandy, and people actually died. People were drowned in their basements in this neighborhood in New York City, USA, and they were pretty happy about it when the governor came through with a plan. And yet at the same time, Mayor Bloomberg was steadfastly against the prospect of buying out businesses or people on the shorelines of New York City. So there was a lot of local context there that by virtue of being a local and also having the story having spooled out a little bit, there was a lot to talk about even though the immediate disaster was passed. So for good or ill, I think that's an approach freelancers need to keep in mind. I don't see any value in us putting our lives or health on the line, without any backup. When they climb Everest, they say it's only a success when you get back down. And I think this is similar.
Karen Schaefer, a freelance public radio journalist based in Ohio. I have a question about tools. Unlike Emily, I really do focus on the Great Lakes. I focus on my region. And I've been focusing on it back when I was a regular staff reporter. So some of my coverage goes back 16 years now. So I'm kind of like the local expert. And oddly enough, I'm a go-to person for a lot of local networks in my region. Case in point, though, and this is where I'm looking for tools, and not just modern tools, but old-fashioned ones. We had a little problem with the Toledo drinking water system that you may have heard about a few weeks ago. I'm working under a grant right now. I happened to be in Indiana visiting my mother, and I was planning the next day to go out and talk to Indiana farmers about their phosphorus runoff, because that's the issue behind the toxic blue-green algae in Lake Erie. And I woke up on Sunday morning, and my mother said, "You might want to look in the newspaper." And I said, "Really?" And there it was. There was this story. It was a national story. And I went, "Oh, my God, I have to jump on this." But I don't have a smartphone. I just have a dumb phone. I had my laptop with me, but my mother doesn't have home Wi-Fi, so I'm working on her ancient, cranky laptop. I had my recording equipment with me. I couldn't get there on Sunday. I'd already missed, some essential places. I called NPR. I did everything I could. But By Monday, I was the only public radio reporter, in fact, the only public radio reporter, including NPR, who was actually there when the mayor said, "Hi, we've turned the drinking water back on, it's okay," and then continued to follow up. And I've done nothing but algae stories for the last month. But the point is, I didn't have the tools that a lot of, you know, I used to have a smartphone, but I can't afford it now. I didn't have the tools that a lot of people had. What I had was, I know that I need to call the mayor's office. Let's start with that. I know that I should contact the public information director for, you know, the fire department or whatever to find out about water distribution sites. I need, you know. And so I made those simple phone calls. And then on site, I would say, "Help, I need, who should I talk to? Oh, and how far away is that? Okay." And I just like walked it through and I got the story. But what else can we be looking for? You know?
Well, I want to first say, since you brought up the question of the Great Lakes and being in Ohio, that's actually where I grew up in Cleveland. In the 60s, in the middle of all that stuff that went on with the Cuyahoga River and Lake Erie and da-da-da-da-da-da-da, we actually have some resources for people covering the Great Lakes. Go to greatlakescoastalresilience.org. And we have been partnering with the Association of State Floodplain Managers on a recent project that represents, because the Great Lakes have some special issues that people have to understand that are very different from what you face with hurricanes like Sandy and Katrina. One of the stories up there, in fact, that's very interesting, this is not a water quality phosphorus thing like Toledo, but there is a story of St. Joseph, Michigan, with a no-build ordinance dealing with the problem of people who like to build further and further out on the shore when lake levels decline and then have their houses badly exposed when lake levels rise again, which they do on a regular basis. But there's a number of resources up there. The one of the things about a situation like Toledo, and we were acutely aware of it because we'd been working with the city of Toledo in that project, public health. Don't forget the public health department. Because if anybody's going to know the impact of that stuff in the water and what public health consequences are, those are the people, hopefully, that, you know, if they don't have adequate answers, then the question is, why don't they, of course? If they're not, you know, but that certainly is another source to go to. But you're right. You, knowing who to ask is every bit as important as having a smartphone in your hand. You know, the planning department, public health, for that sort of thing. Toledo also has an environmental department, which would probably have been another source of information at the local level. So, yeah, think about who's actually going to be the players in this particular game for this story.
Saul Turnus, also from the Great Lakes up in Toronto. thinking, you know, when you're talking about some of what's going on down here, I'm thinking of floodplains and a lot of the development in floodplains in Toronto. That's sort of how Toronto became conscious of floodplains when we had the remnants of Hurricane Hazel back in the late 50s, and a lot of rules were changed in terms of where you could build and couldn't build. But that hasn't happened in a lot of other communities, I've noticed. I'm thinking of the Mississippi. I'm thinking of the competing pressures. I'm wondering what kind of competing pressures you find as a planner in terms of you sort of that advance mitigation for and building of resilience for local for disasters in different communities, and not just hurricanes, but it could be flooding in Great Lakes states. It could be other kinds of. It could be a tsunami. It could be an earthquake. Nuclear power plants, for instance, built on fault lines. There are some of those. I'm thinking of the dredging of, if I recall correctly, in the Mississippi Delta in the New Orleans area. That's created some of the problems, I guess, in terms of making shorelines more vulnerable to the effects of a Katrina. I wonder if you have any thoughts about actual pressures being exerted in the planning process by industry that sort of are anti-mitigation, have an anti-mitigation effect, and how you deal with them?
Well, you know, I would broaden the question a little bit, because an awful lot of the development pressure in these vulnerable places along rivers and lakefronts has not been industry, it's been residential development. And the good news is, especially if you go out to places like Iowa, as a result of the 2008 floods and the earlier the 1993 floods, and by the way, I'm just in my next life, I'm in conversations with a publisher about doing a series of two books on those two events, the 1993 and 2008 Midwest floods. So topic of great concern to me. You'll find that they have actually spent a lot of money through the Hazard Mitigation Grant Program and other funds, CDBG money, et cetera, the local funds, to buy out a lot of those riverfront properties and vacate them, turn them into open space in order to ameliorate those problems. So there's actually a good deal of progress being made in those areas on those fronts. That's a little harder to do with industrial riverfront or lakefront properties, just because they're a lot more expensive and you're displacing jobs, and it gets to be a very different question than getting homeowners to relocate. But homeowners have been a significant aspect of the problem. One interesting thing that is very observable is that it's been, in over the last 20 years, a lot easier to do those buyouts along riverfront properties than along the seacoast. People are much more, because the program is voluntary, people are much more reluctant to part with an oceanfront property than with a riverfront property. And so that's where the big problem actually remains, is, you know, the Jersey Shore and places like that, more so than, say, in the Mississippi Valley and all those tributaries. But, you know, the other thing about industry is, I'll give you an example from Cedar Rapids, which had the big floods in 2008. Those industries are still there, Quaker Oats, I forget some of the other firms, Penford, et cetera. But they do have their own money and the willingness to invest in mitigating their own properties at a level that's very different from typical residential situations. So to the extent that a community wants to keep those jobs in place, and if the company's willing to put out the money to stay there, very often the community is going to embrace that. But if they do the proper mitigation to protect that site, it may not necessarily be such a bad result.
Just real quick, you know, because we're in New Orleans, we've spent most of our time talking about hurricanes and flooding and things like that. But when you talk about planning and where people choose to build, it's a huge issue with wildfires out west right now.
Oh, yeah.
Michael Kodas.
And that's almost entirely residential.
Right. Michael Kodas, an SEJ member who probably a lot of you know, I mean, has done a lot of reporting about something that I had never heard of before I started reading his stuff, the WUI, the Woodland-Urban Interface. And, you know, how many people are building in the red zones out there and things like that. So there's a lot of disasters where planning is an awful big component of it.
Yeah, by the way, we have a report you can order from us online called Planning for Wildfires, which we did back in 2005. So we have a few other resources I didn't mention.
Gloria Dickey, Center for Environmental Journalism. My question is for Scott. You had mentioned stocking up on supplies like food and gas before going in, but the handout also mentions getting a hot meal at a charity dinner. So my question, when you have journalists going en masse to these disaster areas, how do you prevent yourself from becoming a drain on local emergency resources?
Well, I mean, part of that is why, you know, for us, we wanted to bring as much as we could with us, because, well, you know, I mean, I think you sort of have to judge it a little bit. I mean, sometimes you can be in a place where there's more charity than is actually needed, you know, and so if you take a hot meal, you're not taking it away from somebody else who's going to need it. In the case after Katrina on the Gulf Coast, everything was needed, and so we didn't want to take away anything that somebody else was going to need, and so that's why we did make sure that we brought all of our supplies, all of our water, and things like that. And then you run into the situation that I think, you know, every journalist who's covered, you know, probably a disaster or a war or anything terrible has, is how much do you help then? You know, so I mentioned that we, you know, very jealously guarded our gas, but we were pretty generous with water and food when people would ask for it. You know, yeah, you keep a little bit of an eye on it yourself. I mean, you know, like, am I down to my last case of water? Do, you know, but... you know, and how much longer am I going to need that for? You know, and then when we left, we gave away everything that we weren't taking back. We gave away everything but the gas, basically. So, you know, so I do think that you have to take that into consideration and be mindful of, am I draining resources that somebody else needs? You know, again, one of the nice things about hurricanes is a lot of people clear out in advance if they can. Unfortunately, the people who are left behind are the people who couldn't and have the least resources and then the least, you know, means to, you know, to recover afterward. And so that makes it really hard. You're often dealing with people who were already in a bad situation before the disaster and are an even worse one now. So, you know, I always found that a little bit difficult, like sort of how do you balance that out and think about it. But I do think it's an important consideration, you know, in terms of thinking about, you know, what's my role here, and, you know, A, I don't want to become a part of, you know, I mean, the worst thing for somebody who goes out to cover a disaster is becoming part of the disaster and needing to be rescued themselves. That happened when I was covering Isabel. I don't remember where from, but a crew went out in the middle of the storm, and I was at the Kitty Hawk Fire and Rescue Station. And they had to go out after them, and they were pretty upset. And, you know, they kind of took it out on us, and we're like, well, wait, we're not the ones out there. We stayed here with you, like you asked us to. So, you know, but they were pretty upset that they had to go out and rescue a crew of journalists who, it turned out, took refuge in a hot tub, because that's not a terrible place to take refuge in the middle of a sandstorm. So,
all right. We're down to our last 5 minutes, so perhaps keep the questions concise.
Brian Norcross from the Weather Channel. A couple of quick points. So one is I'm from Miami, which is sort of the epicenter of so many things, good and bad, you know. And one of the things that has happened there is that, like so much of a part of American culture, I think, is that we don't really do anything until there's a disaster, and then we react pretty well in general. And as a result of Hurricane Andrew, the building code in South Florida, Miami-Dade and Broward County only, not in the rest of the state, but only there. They build buildings like battleships now. The incredible explosion of growth that's going on right now, it's all incredibly strong buildings, the strongest buildings built in the world. And you have the urban development boundary, it's called, between the Everglades and the city, which was put in place a long time ago there, which they have not learned to do yet in the West, is actually draw a line and say you cannot build beyond that line.
Except in Portland.
Yeah, there are other places. I'm just on in general, like in the, yes, there are other places that do a variety of things, yes, for sure. On the satellite phone, I got a call the week after Super Typhoon Haiyan said, we want you to go to the Philippines. And I was actually heading to New York. And so I did all my shopping at REI because I was only allowed one carry-on for food, water, and bedding. But I would not go there without going back to Atlanta and getting a satellite phone. And our freelancers, now part of the deal is that they say, I want a satellite phone, for you to supply a satellite phone. So I completely agree. I didn't want to go in the middle of some place with no communications without having that. But my question is for Scott. So often, being in the weather business, we see that really good print folks, and TV folks too, by the way, non-meteorologist people get the weather facts wrong. They misinterpret, they look at a forecast and use that as the conclusion. And I'm just wondering, it even gets harder now with resources and everything, how is there a way that you can imagine that can be better, or is that... Or how does that happen, do you think? Is it that you guys concentrate so much on what you're doing and seeing that the weather facts, you know, don't get the same level of, let me really go and research that? I take it more out of the AP Wire and believe them that they've done that, or...
I think what you're talking about, unfortunately, is what happens to any specialist when they see their specialty written about. It's never going to have the nuance or the level of detail or the amount of understanding that they have. What I think is really interesting, I'd be curious what you think of the quality of them, but recently there have been so many new blogs and news sites and things like that that have sprung up that have really become much more focused on the weather. I mean, you know, 8 or 10 years ago when I was covering this stuff, it was pretty much, well, there was the Weather Channel, and then there was stuff like the Hurricane Tracker blog or things like that. But nowadays you've got, you know, Gawker Media has The Vane, you've got, you know, Eric Holthaus writing for Slate, you've got Andrew Friedman writing for Mashable, you've got Climate Central. There are just so many places where there are people who are specialists in weather, climate, and sometimes the overlap between the two. Some of them are meteorologists, some of them aren't, but some of them are, have just become very dedicated to reporting on the details and nuances of weather. And I think that is true of so many subjects now. I mean, as somebody who used to be a general assignment reporter and, you know, is now more of a specialist, you know, I wish that all the resources that exist now had existed when I was a general assignment reporter. You know, I may lament the fact that we don't have the giant newspaper companies behind us anymore supporting us, but I find that the ability to find the kind of detailed, nuanced information that you're talking about is so much easier to get if you want to find it. Now, I mean, that's the question. Are you going to put the effort into finding it and going out there? But I think there's so much analysis of almost everything that you could think of that there's somebody who's a specialist in now, and often many people who are specialists in, that it, that, you know, you should be able to quickly educate yourself on the things that you need to know.
I'm sorry. Hi, Kathy Florsch. I'm Rhode Island freelance photographer and writer. I'm curious about the insurance incentives for reconstruction, and I know a little bit about what's happened in Rhode Island, so I'm curious about your experience, Jim.
Insurance is often a complex question because it's really fragmented. You know, if you are lucky enough to have the kind of disaster where private insurance dominates the scene, you can get get recovery moving a lot faster because you get the money directly from private insurance companies, as in wildfires, which are still covered by, you know, homeowners insurance as just a fire. So on the other hand, the NFIP is, you know, floods. Flood insurance is basically a program that's been nationalized effectively since 1968, and it's got the usual encumbrances of, you know, being a federal program. The real issue with the NFIP today is that the program has been insolvent for a while. It's been insolvent ever since Hurricane Katrina. A lot of that traces back to the original incentives, which provided subsidized insurance for grandfathered properties that have pre-existed the creation of a flood insurance rate map in a particular area. Congress took a stab in the summer of 2012 at remedying that problem over time with something called the Biggert Waters Act. If you're not familiar with this, this is really critical to covering this kind of an event in terms of the long-term recovery process. Biggert Waters is intended to gradually phase in, you know, actuarially sound rates for all properties, including those previously grandfathered properties. Within months, Sandy hits, the crap hits the fan because people start looking at the increases in rates that are going to accompany the new rate maps, the changes in the flood maps as a result of the experience of Hurricane Sandy, the existing Biggert Waters changes, and all of a sudden there's a backlash that reaches the halls of Congress, particularly with people representing places like Long Island and New Jersey, and now you get Graham Waters Richmond. Notice there's one name that shows up on both sides, which is Maxine Waters from Los Angeles, who, you know, effectively backtracked on the issue. And suddenly they're undoing some of the changes they made with Biggert Waters. So long story short, because you could get into a whole dissertation on this whole process of the reform of flood insurance. Believe me, whole books could be written on what's going on with that. But Congress is having trouble making up its mind between wanting an actuarially sound, you know, fiscally responsible flood insurance program and wanting to curry favor with the property owners who have to pay the tab. And admittedly, some of them are, you know, more low income, but a lot of them are quite well off. And you could solve the social equity problems on the low end with some, you know, some kinds of subsidies, but you don't, that's not what exactly what's going on. And so, you know, Congress can't make up its mind which way it wants to go on this thing, and that's basically fundamentally the problem.
Okay. Did you want to add anything there? Okay. All right. Well, we have to wrap this session up, but please join me in thanking James and Scott for sharing their wisdom with us today.
Thank you all. And I just have one final thought. Recognizing the great work that Mark Schlifstein did on the disaster in waiting with the hurricane, you know, we're not all Mark Schlifstein, but we each have that story in our backyard because we're talking about human nature. And just extending this theme on flood insurance, what happens when people are told that their home is in a floodplain because the map's been redrawn and suddenly now they're getting accurate information that their home could be flooded? They don't say, hey, thanks. They say, take me out of that floodplain. I don't want to pay the insurance. So the problem...
Which doesn't mean the risk was removed.
The risk is not removed. So the problem that he's talking about begins at home with individuals. And my only point was listening to you all talk. It really occurred to me that we all have these disasters pending in our backyards, and they're going to happen, because it does happen. But anyway, this has been really good. We're going to break. We only have about 5 minutes before the next session is supposed to start. It starts right next door, because we're a group session. Run to the bathroom, do your thing, whatever, and just sit yourself down. And you guys, thanks again for coming.